Hey Angie, how are you?
I am doing good. I'm just kind of sifting through a lot of different changes right now. So booking for me has been a little bit slow. I did that on purpose, of course. But yeah, the fall, I feel, for interestingly, like everyone's saying that it's time to slow down and go inwards and kind of move into that hibernation part of the year. And I feel that it's completely the opposite for me. I feel like things from about the beginning of October to the end of the year just accelerate and there's no stopping.
Yeah, I kind of feel that too. Also, it's amazing to see you and be with you again in this space. I've really missed you since our last episode of Shuffling, and I'm so happy to be doing this again. But yeah, and maybe that's because like this time of year is when people do kind of journey inward, and that's kind of like what we do, you know? So I guess yeah, for us it gets a little busier because people are kind of wanting to kind of do that work, you know? But I definitely feel that too. Here we are back with another Shuffling Through History episode, which we subtitled What We Know, Don't Know, and Think We Know About the Tarot. And today's episode is going to be a little bit different, a little bit special. So tell us what we're talking about today.
Today I'm excited because you actually asked me a couple weeks ago whether it would be fun to dive into tarot and cartomancy traditions in Mexico. And I thought this was such a fun idea. So in the last few years, there's been a real emphasis, or at least in my corner of social media, on folk magic practices in North America and various cultural diasporas, including Latin America. My dad is Mexican, and some of you might remember that I shared that my dad was the first person to ever read my cards or teach me, which shocked me at the time because he's a devoutly religious Mormon man. So today we're going to talk a little bit about Mexican mysticism and cartomancy and more. So I want to begin with a caveat and say that much of what I personally know has been through my experience, of course, but also through my personal effort to understand my culture as a person who actually didn't grow up in Mexico. As a first-generation American and mixed ethnicity kiddo, many of us can identify with the feeling of sort of stuck in between. There's a phrase that's ni de aquí, ni de allá, which is, it means not from here and not from there. And I'm going to share my experiences with that as well, and getting into some cool research that we found that gives us some more historical context.
And when we release this episode, you won't have heard this yet, Angie, but I will have spoken to a guest named Chanti Tacoronte Perez, who also shares a lot about the same experience. I'm really excited for you to hear that episode. Her family comes from Cuba, and she talks a lot about the same kind of limbo space. But there is so much rich history to be covered in each of Mexico's regions and indigenous cultures. And it's also important to say that Mexican people are not a monolith, and Latin America is also not a monolith. If this episode excites you, we encourage you to look deeper into some of the more mystical practices in Mexico and the rest of Latin America. And as always, if you want to shoot us an email or share with us on Instagram, if you have any experiences to add to this conversation, please do so. Please let us know. So without further ado, I'm going to let you lead us on this journey, Angie.
So, we're going to talk about mysticism in Mexico. And the mysticism as we know it today is heavily intertwined with Catholicism. No doubt, if you've been to your local Latin American import stores, you probably have your regular grocery items and your housewares, but they also might have an aisle where you have things like Florida water or novena candles and other magical tools and protective amulets. But folk magic practices in Mexico reach far back into history, way before the colonization by the Spanish in the 1500s. So we'll begin there.
According to mexicolore.co.uk, magic and sorcery are ancient, with some of the first traditions as early as the Olmec civilization, which dates back to as far as 1600 BCE and spanned into 350 BCE. But much of what we know now can be more easily recognizable with the classic Maya in the late post-classical central Mexico regions. This is where we start to see art and sculpture depicting what are known as wahi, or something like an animal spirit or coessence. Sometimes this meant that an animal such as a bat, snake, jaguar, or otherwise might be depicted by itself or personified with human characteristics like skeletal arms and legs. It's interesting because, this is a side note, I follow A witch. I forget her last name, but her first name is Sorsha. She's amazing. I follow her on Instagram, but also on YouTube. And she talks a lot about Irish folklore and mysticism. And she talks about the Morrigan a lot, who also was a personified, often as a crow, sort of half animal, half human. So, you know, it's just interesting to see how across civilizations and cultures, there's been this kind of animal human connection. Starting in the classic period around 200 CE is when we start to see the gods as we know them now. And this goes on through what's known as the contact period, or when the Spanish arrived in what's now Mexico around 1519. There's a ton of really cool information out there about animal coessences, planetary magic, and history before the arrival of the Spanish. And for more reading on that, we recommend checking out Erica Buenaflor's work and the many books that she's written.
Awesome. So we are going to skip forward a little bit in time, but we wanted to lay the groundwork in ancient times because it's important to highlight the fact that before Catholicism hit the scene with the Spanish, there was already a rich tapestry of beliefs, myths, and legend that inform what magical practices look like now in modern day Mexico. At the time of the arrival of the conquistadors, literally the conquerors in Tenochtitlan, which we know of today as Mexico City, they brought with them Spanish priests, enslaved Africans, Afro-Haitians, and Afro-Cubans. They brought a number of different animals that are not native to the Americas, including domesticated horses, pigs, dogs, sheep, as well as rice, sugarcane, and wheat. Bartolomé de las Casas, a Catholic priest who wrote about the atrocities committed by the colonizers against the indigenous people, along with other Catholic missionaries, set right to work converting the people to the church.
And baptized they did, many under the threat of violence. The native people of the area and those who were brought to Tenochtitlan with the Spanish, who brought their own cultural practices, were resistant to the full adoption of Catholicism. Initially, there were massive punishments by the Spanish to anyone who did not submit, making anything outside of Catholicism punishable by death. However, over time, because of the resistance, the views became more lenient because of their persistence. The Catholic Church didn't claim or encourage these views, quite the opposite, but instead began to coexist alongside the melding of Vodou, Santeria, Candomblé, and pre-contact practices of the area.
As history continues, and like many other places throughout the world who have been influenced by the Catholic Church, we start to see saints and off-brand saints emerge. And what I mean by off-brand is that some of these saints are not officially recognized by the Catholic Church. This by itself is a super interesting dive, and we recommend a Google of the saints of specific places. But the ones we're going to concentrate on here would be the pre-contact goddess that over time evolved from being Coatlicue Tonantzin, who is a Mother Earth figure, to the contact period's La Virgen de Guadalupe, literally the Virgin of Guadalupe, or better known as Our Lady of Guadalupe, who appeared in a vision to indigenous priest Juan Diego Cuautlatoatzin. She is a figure specific to Mexico, along with a few other Mexican saints, including San Juan Diego himself, San Charbel, San Judas, Santa Muerte, and more.
Now we're going to talk a little bit about cartomancy for a bit. Although divination existed by other means, such as cowrie shell throwing infused with the enslaved African influence, and divination by smoke or otherwise, the Spanish also brought card decks with them. You'll remember from our previous episodes on tarot history how cartomancy at this time in Europe is developing roots in divination as well. According to WOPC.co.uk, quote, Mexico shares a long tradition with Spain in the field of playing cards. The early Spanish colonists carried packs of cards with them. When these were out, new ones would have been made from local materials, maybe drum skins, rawhide, or paper, end quote. As well as the regular run-of-the-mill card games, we have divination that use the regular playing card deck similar to what we've talked about in our previous episodes, using the four suits and the court cards to intuit messages from the cards. Around this time, Loteria emerges as well. According to tarotheritage.com, Loteria began as a 15th century Italian board game with a lot of the same iconography we see across many playing cards and tarot decks today. Around 1769, New Spain established a national lottery, and this lottery became a popular game to play at parties. New Spain, by the way, is the name that Hernan Cortes called the territory they'd colonized. We know it as modern-day Mexico. The boards were made by artists locally, but then they reached the hands of Don Clément Jacques, Don Clément, a French businessman who supplied the army with food and ammo during the Mexican Revolution, began to print the deck commercially in 1887, and this version of the game was distributed to the soldiers along with other supplies. Tarot Heritage likens the commercial printing to the Tarot de Marseille of the Loteria world.
Loteria is a game similar to Bingo, but with a few key differences, and its imagery is very well known. I have a lot of fond memories playing it with my family, and as I'm sure a lot of other people do as well. On a search through Wikipedia, I found the following, quote, "The origin of Loteria can be traced far back into history. The game originated in Italy in the 15th century and was brought to New Spain, modern Mexico, as we said, in 1769. In the beginning, Loteria was a hobby of the upper classes and eventually made its way down to Mexican fairs. The images Don Clément used in his card designs have now become iconic in Mexican culture, as well as gaining popularity in the US and some European countries. Don Clément's cards also had a part in representing and normalizing different aspects of Mexico's national identity during the 19th century. This can be seen with the card of El Soldado, Spanish for the soldier, which was used to reference war as a part of Mexico's national identity during that time. Many of the pictures used in Don Clément's Loteria resembled the major arcana in the tarot," end quote. And of course, as we know by now, those were eventually used for divination.
I'm just going to pause for a second because I would love to hear you talk a little bit about your experience playing this game with your family. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's very like we would kind of bust it out after Sunday dinner or something. We don't play a lot of games in my family. Like, I'm not much of a board game player, but this one is always a riot. It's super fun. It moves pretty quickly. And if you can get like everybody in the spirit, then it gets kind of rowdy too. Some people will gamble or kind of play with, you know, doing shots or something. It depends on the family. I grew up Mormon, so that didn't apply to me, but
true.
We would play using beans as markers, and my dad would call out the riddle before starting to pull the cards. And we would just play, calling out the name that was on the card. And so we didn't do all of the riddles and stuff like that, which we'll get to in a second. But yeah, that was my experience. It was super fun.
Yeah. And your dad, you know, I know introduced you to tarot. Did he also use Loteria in that same way at all?
No, my dad's pretty traditional when it comes to reading the tarot. I think he really likes to read using the Marseille. Pretty much that's it, you know.
Okay. Only a traditionalist.
Yeah, he likes, I mean, he'll read with the minor arcana, but he likes to read with only the major arcana.
Got it.
Yeah.
So Loteria cards each have their own little riddles, as you said, attached to them. When playing the game, depending on the family and their style of playing, they might just call out the name of the card, or they might call out the riddle that corresponds to the card, and you have to guess the right card in order to mark it on your playing sheet. When divining with Loteria cards, it's highly dependent on the reader's association of the images, which is sort of reminiscent of the way that Lenormand was intended to work. For example, associating El Arbol with growth and steadfastness. You can also use the riddle correspondences to inform the meanings of the cards. For example, the riddle that corresponds with La Sirena goes like this.
Con los cantos de la sirena no te vayas marear.
Don't go dizzy with the siren songs. I love that.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Some associations might be to keep your head on straight, not to get caught up in a dream world or fantasy.
Cartomancy outside of Loteria seems to follow a pretty similar structure to the way that most playing cards are used for divination throughout Europe. Hearts representing emotional matters associated with water, clubs representing calling or destiny associated with fire, spades representing doubts, fears, and change associated with air, and diamonds representing fortune, luck, and more material matters associated with earth.
Can we stop there for just a second? Sure. I just wanted to like sit with how close or not close these associations were with like tarot. You know, I thought it was interesting. So I felt like water and emotion is kind of very close to the way people talk about tarot. And then clubs would be swords, right? Oh no, clubs would be wands.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so representing calling or destiny, which is close, but also like a little different, right?
I mean, I kind of see, I can see it, especially with like the two or three of wands where he's kind of standing on that portal. It's a very like Luke Skywalker moment in my perspective. And so I kind of see that. But
And I guess pursuing your passion, you know, maybe is another. And then spades would be swords, and this is representing doubts, fears, and change, which I kind of liked the idea of change thrown in there, you know.
Yeah, as far as I understand, it seems to be like a much more kind of like when you pull a spade, it's much more of a negative connotation, which if you're looking at like the Rider-Waite imagery, the swords can look pretty like, I mean, the colors are like gray, you know, it's like scary looking on its face, but of course you can interpret it in a myriad of ways, but it's not so, I guess, wide of an interpretation when you're looking at spades, as far as I understand.
Yeah. And not so maybe like necessarily mental. I mean, doubts and fears are mental, but not talking about maybe communication as much or whatever. And then diamonds representing fortune, luck, and more material matters. And that would be pentacles. And I like that idea of fortune and luck, which isn't necessarily something I hear talked about as much as material and maybe even body. I hear body talked about a lot, you know, with pentacles. But that idea of like luck and fortune, I think is interesting.
It'd be interesting to kind of see that interpretation. If you saw like four of pentacles, for example, you see like the little man holding on to, it's very like hoarding energy, and have that portrayed with diamonds. It's a very billionaire's card.
The numerological significance seemed to follow pretty similarly to other card systems as well. Corey Thomas Hutchinson, who's one of the voices behind the New World Witchery podcast, has a great resource on this. If you'd like to read more, check out his book titled 54 Devils, which he explains learning card divination, where he explains learning card divination with a deck of playing cards.
Cartomancy all over the world has tended to be a means of prediction and fortune telling in the past, all the way up to pretty recently, where many readers have turned cartomancy into a tool of introspection and clarification. So we've talked a little bit about this before on the podcast. You know, we've had even guest interviews where we talk about like how we use it now versus how it might have been used in the past. And I still feel that there's like, this is still so recent. Like I still have clients that come to me and are asking me for prediction. Like they want to know what's happening in their future. And I don't know about you, but I don't like that kind of pressure. Like no matter what, it seems like no matter how much I emphasize this with some clients, they still want me to tell them what to do or what will happen. It's at least in like, in my experience, specifically with like my Mexican American clients or Mexican clients, it can be like really tied in with superstitions and stuff like that. And that's not unique to Latin American countries, of course, but yeah, it is very interesting to note that.
Yeah. I mean, I think where I sit with all that right now is I think that there's a tradition of that. And I think that certain readers maybe can bring that, you know, and that come from that tradition and that lineage. And so I think there's a place for that. And I think there are people that you can go to for that, you know, and I think for me, like I have really loved thinking about divining as a verb, you know, and as an action, as a relationship, I guess, you know, with spirit and as more of a conversational aspect. So
yeah,
in a reading in which you are quote unquote divining, maybe some things do come through, some messages do come through that are, you know, future oriented. But I like to think of it more as like a relationship, and not that you're like just trying to sort of transact from divine, you know, just sort of like tap into to divine, like get your answer and then like tap out, you know. It's like, you're actually like having a relationship, building a relationship, you know, courting and cultivating a relationship with spirit that is going to take a while to develop. Like, you know, you wouldn't just knock on someone's house and have never met them and be like, tell me my future. Yeah, you know, like you need to like develop that relationship, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and I think I've said this before, but sometimes I like to provide like a wall to bounce off of. So I will use methods like pulling cards for yes or no questions, or I'll use methods like pulling cards for a time frame, and then kind of turn that back on to my client and say, how does that feel to you? Is that a yes or a no? You know, doing things like that, or using pendulums or bone throws or anything like that. But I like to leave that more up to them. So
Yeah. And I still really want to experiment with Lenormand. I mean, I still have not touched Lenormand. And I know that Lenormand can be used for much more of those like yes, no, kind of straight up just answers, you know, and I think it would be interesting to play around with that, you know. So we mentioned a bit ago that in addition to cards, there were a number of other divinatory practices that were around pre-contact. In an article by David Bowles, who is a teacher of literature and of Nahuatl at UTRVG, he writes that types of divination vary from gazing into a crystal, palmistry, casting lots or grains of maize, knot divination, astrology, and water scrying in a basin made of obsidian. Many of these practices still exist and are handed down orally from teacher to student. As we stated previously, Mexico is a melting pot of cultures. Even the mal ojo, or evil eye, is a symbol that made its way from the Moors, who were a group of Muslim North Africans that invaded Spain in 711, made their imprint on Spanish culture, and of course, from there, the Spanish culture imprinted itself in Mexico. We also want to mention that there is also a significant population of Japanese, Chinese, Malay, and Filipino immigrants in Mexico that have brought their customs, many of whom didn't migrate to Mexico until the 19th century, but still have helped to shape Mexican culture as it is today.
You have all sorts of protective talismans that include the mal ojo, like you said. We also have el ojo del venado, which is translated to the deer's eye, which is actually a velvet bean. Similarly, silver or gold charms in the shape of hands, arms, feet, evil eye beads, and crosses, and you might find them on a bracelet or a necklace made out of red string or on a chain with red beads. You'll often see these chains on newborn babies placed on them after birth to protect them from the spirits of the underworld until they can be baptized. Red string, by the way, is meant to protect one from negative spirits and is a folk tradition in cultures all over the world. Effigies of saints and other pre-contact gods and goddesses and spirits called donals, which take the form of an alebrije, which if you've seen the movie Coco, they kind of depict this with Coco's dog, or sorry, not Coco's dog, Miguel's dog in the movie. This is kind of an animal companion spirit that's part of the magical worker, and that might be present in buildings, altars, artwork, and more. I wish we could get more into the folklore and superstitions and traditions. We would be here like all day.
Yeah.
many of us in Latin America have heard of the superstitions of El Cucuy, who's kind of like a boogeyman figure, La Llorona, or the stories of the Nahuales, who are sorcerers who can shapeshift. We couldn't possibly cover all of them today, or even in a single episode. So if you find this fascinating, you might have a lot of fun diving into this rabbit hole of Mexico's rich cultural history.
We are, however, going to focus in on one additional specific aspect of Mexican folklore and religious tradition for part two of this series next week, which is the Santa Muerte. We hope you'll join us for that. All of our sources from today's episode are in the show notes, and we encourage you to explore these topics more for yourself, as we have only barely touched the surface of them in this episode.
And if you're enjoying these shuffling through history episodes, write to us at isotpod@gmail.com. That's isotpod@gmail.com. Or send us a message on Instagram telling us what you think. You can also leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, which will help other folks discover the show.
All right. Thank you for this, Angie. And thanks everybody for listening.
And we'll see you next time.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's birdgerhl_, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.